Hey, my guest today is my friend Ellie Honig. Ellie is a former federal prosecutor with the SDNY in New York. He is a CNN legal analyst. He wrote the amazing book about Bob Barr called Hatchet Man, which really was a great inside look at the manipulation of the DOJ during the Trump era. He has got a new book out called Untouchable, How Powerful People Get Away With It, where he goes through a number of very high-profile cases of how the rich and powerful avoided justice. And some of them didn't quite avoid it forever, but how the things that would put an ordinary person in jail somehow with the richest folks in America can be delayed and deferred and pushed back. It's getting great reviews, and I'm really anticipating reading the book myself. So with us today is Ellie Honig.
There was also maintained what was called an enemies list.
Democrats want Republicans dead.
I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody.
The women with the least likelihood of getting pregnant are the ones most worried about having abortions.
On January 6th of 2021, you had tens of thousands of people peacefully protesting.
You're the president of the United States. You can declassify just by saying it's declassified.
It's not a right-wing conspiracy theory. It's not QAnon. It's real.
I'm Rick Wilson, and this is the Enemies List. One of the things I had in my notes before we had this conversation was that, you know, and I've been around politics for a long time now, it seems like the legal wrangling, like the lawfare in Washington has reached a level that we have rarely seen in our lifetimes, like not even like during the Nixon era, but the fact that there's so much litigation, so many investigations, so many competing moments here where the president, the former president are both being investigated. You've got the former president being investigated for trying to overthrow the 2020 election. You've got this incredible constellation. I mean, have we reached like peak DC lawyering?
We have, Rick. And it's so funny you raise this because, so I teach undergrads at Rutgers University, where I went in Jersey. And we had and I'm teaching a class this semester on the history of the Justice Department from RFK.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
And we were going through sort of, you know, Watergate and then the Iran-Contra and Janet Reno as AG and Whitewater and, you know, Ken Starr all the way through the present. And I said to my students, I cannot stress to you enough what a crazy moment we are in right now. We have one special counsel, a federal prosecutor investigating the sitting president. We have another special counsel investigating the former president, who is about to run for the next presidency, probably against the current guy. I mean, you know, there are so many dimensions. We're beyond three-dimensional here. We're in some other dimension, Twilight Zone. And the guy at the center of it all, by the way, is Merrick Garland, who I'm sure we'll talk about, and I talk about quite a bit in the book. But boy, does he have some big decisions to make.
It really is one of those things that Merrick Garland is – I don't even know if he realizes how consequential his decisions – in these two areas, in these two cases, are going to be for the presidency for the country going forward.
Yep. No, you're absolutely right. I mean, look, both of these decisions are going to impact the 2024 election. I mean, of course, look, we know that there cannot be an indictment of Joe Biden while he's sitting president, right? We remember from Robert Mueller days that DOJ has this policy going back to the Watergate era that we will not indict a sitting president. By the way, I do have a chapter in my book about that. And you know what's interesting about that policy that I always wanted to stress? People sometimes say DOJ can't indict the sitting president, but that's not actually accurate. The accurate way to say it is DOJ long ago decided that they don't want to even try. Right. They would voluntarily refrain from doing so. Now, look, there's good reasons that for that. And if you read the memos where they lay out these policies, it's not even – the memos aren't even like, well, what's the law? The memos are basically like, how the hell would this work? Right? Like, how would the government function? Right? So Biden is not going to get indicted, but if the facts play out, it's possible that Robert Hur, the special counsel, comes back and issues a report and says, I do think there's enough here to indict. By the way, in contrast to Robert Mueller, I think you and I agree. I make the argument in this book that Mueller spit the bit by just giving us this nonsense. I can't say, but I won't say, but I will. But, you know, I think Mueller failed by not even stating his conclusion.
Well, I think Mueller failed think Mueller failed by, one, having that weirdly, you know, esoteric conclusion, but also letting Bill Barr
take command of it and say, "Oh, nothing, nothing to see here, folks. Move on."
Now you're on to my first book,
which I loved. By the way, I loved that book. I thought because I really thought Bill Barr was one of the most dangerous figures in American politics during the Trump era.
Absolutely,
and.
Absolutely, and he's on this never-ending image rehabilitation tour. He's just with some Bill Maher. He goes, he does his tours. Yeah, I mean, the guy, and the funny thing is, this is a minor point, but, you know, he always tries to play it like, oh, I don't care about my image.
I mean, the rehab tour is, like, so intensive now, I'm expecting him to show up at fucking Coachella. The comedy sounds of Bill Barr, ladies and gentlemen. So, your new book, which I am really looking forward to, because I love the Barr book, as I said. It's called Untouchable, How Powerful People Get Away With It. Now, you go through in this book folks like Donald Trump, Jeffrey Epstein, Bill Cosby, Harvey Weinstein. Tell us why it seems in America today, and I mean, I have my opinions, but tell us why you think so many people at such a high level seem to evade the course of justice in this country.
Yeah, so that is the central question of the book. And Rick, I should say, the way this book came about was really so organic because I did my first book on Barr, and a couple weeks after it published, HarperCollins, the publisher said, what do you want to do next? And I said, I don't know. That was kind of my idea. I don't really have anything left. And they said, well, what is the number one question you get asked most? Take a few days, think about it. And I was like, oh, I don't need to take a few days. I'll tell you right on this call, how the hell does he get away with it, right? And the he can vary, almost always a he. And the most common he is Donald Trump. But as you say, it's the people you listed. We talk about in the book, members of Congress. I talk about in the book, CEOs, CFOs, all of that. And if I had to boil it down, there's obviously no one magic bullet here. There's no one solution, but I sort of lay blame in three different sectors. One, we have a legal system that creates all sorts of advantages for powerful people. We just talked about the Mueller, the policy, the DOJ policy. Now, that's probably more on prosecutors, but we have various legal factors that favor powerful people, powerful politicians. Second of all, the smart ones, the savvy ones, know how to manipulate and exploit those advantages. I mean, I was a mafia prosecutor in New York City. I was chief of organized crime in the Southern District. And, you know, I know it's a trendy thing for analysts to go on TV and go, that Trump's like a mob boss. But as I went through the examples of my own cases, I found how literally true that is. So I have, look, there's plenty of mob stories in here. If you like Goodfellas and all that, this is like the real life Goodfellas about murder cases and all this. But so many of the tactics Trump uses are really right out of the mafia playbook, whether just by instinct or whatever. And then third, look, I am quite critical in this book of prosecutors who pulled their punches, of certain policies that prosecutors have that give extra protection to powerful people, certain sort of see no evil type approaches. I'm obviously critical of Bill Barr. I'm critical of Merrick Garland in some respects. I'm critical of Cy Vance, the Manhattan DA. I'm critical of Alexander Acosta, who gave Epstein a free pass.
Epstein a sweetheart deal, knowing what Epstein was.
Yep. And by the way, a lot of the people you listed in the beginning, people may hear, well, Harvey Weinstein, Jeffrey Epstein, Bill Cosby, they all got prosecuted eventually. But I show in each of those cases how they all got free passes right away. The only reason that they ever got prosecuted was one of two things. Media, right? Julie Brown, for example, the great Miami reporter, blew the lid off of Epstein, and political pressure. And if it hadn't been for those things, all these people would have completely walked. Cosby did end up walking anyway, because that prosecutor, that's another one I am very critical of.
Right.
So, so I'd say those three things, the justice system itself, the manipulation of those advantages by the bosses, and shortcomings by prosecutors.
Yeah, I think there's a belief, maybe it's a TV-driven belief in the minds of most people, like, oh, a federal prosecutor is going to find out about X, and man, they're going to be like a dog on a bone on this guy. And they frequently aren't. They frequently
Let me give you sort of, in the book, I talk about this. You know, that can go two ways, because there is such thing in the world of federal prosecutors of wanting to go after a big name, right? I mean, you know, SDNY gets accused of this. Oh, they're just big game hunting, right? They wouldn't care. I mean, the classic example is Martha Stewart, right? There's always been a debate about, would they have gone after some unknown CEO who lied in a proffer about, you know, whatever. I don't know the answer to that. That's not part of the book.
Right.
But DOJ's own guidance, the Justice Manual, the document that goes to every prosecutor in the country, specifically says, if the person you're looking at is a powerful, they don't, doesn't say powerful, but a high profile person, if the case is likely to result in national media coverage, the case has to go to higher and higher levels of review and approval. And I give examples in the book of cases I was involved in at the SDNY, where if they didn't involve anyone who was famous, I would have made the decision at my low level. That would be that. But because a couple of them, one of them I talk about involved a famous Major League Baseball player, had to go way, way, way up the chain as a result. And the natural consequence of that is the more people who review and have to sign off, the more difficult it is to actually bring a charge. The more people can say, I don't see it, I'm killing this.
Right. And the more people who say, oh, this is in the past, it's way in the rearview mirror. Why are you doing this now? Why didn't you bring this to me when it was fresh?
Yes, that too.
I guess I have, and again, I think it's, I think part of this is people have this idea of what prosecutors do based on television. And they always take every case and they always win every case and they always, you know, are relentless and merciless. And I guess that's just not the way it is. But I think that sort of illusion of what prosecutors do is also something that is, I think, and I'll get your thoughts on this, I think it's led to a sort of growing part of the American skepticism about everything government does.
Yeah.
When they see very wealthy people get away with stuff, there, it makes them just like, okay, well, I'm going to get effed if I do this, but you know, this hedge fund guy, nothing happened to him. So
that's
why not,
that's such an interesting point. So I'm going to put this under points I wish I had thought of. But it's really an interesting point. How, you know, prosecutors have a very high profile in this country, especially since a bunch of us now we're on TV and all that. And I think people have a lot of faith in prosecutors. And I think when they see prosecutors coming up short, whether it's Robert Mueller or to be seen on all the special counsel now, or the prosecutor in the Cosby case or the Cy Vance in the original Weinstein case, that shakes public faith in our institutions in a sort of exponential way, because we see prosecutors as the ultimate good guys, the ultimate sort of avengers of justice. Mm-hmm. And when they're pulling up short, I think that really undermines everything.
Yeah, I think that's right. Because, you know, this idea of, you know, we pay our taxes so that we are protected from bad people. I do think, you know, America may be a celebrity obsessed culture, but it's also, I mean, the dark side of that is sometimes when the celebrities do wrong, I think there's almost like a weird obsession with Americans of like, oh, how much are they going to get away with this time?
Yeah.
I mean, Bill Cosby took decades to resolve.
Yeah. Yeah. And so did Harvey Weinstein. I mean, people knew, people came forward. I mean, the Harvey Weinstein case, he's going to die in jail now, but let's remember, there was a point when this model, Ambra Bataliana Gutierrez, came to the NYPD, told her that he had been harassing, you know, sexually harassing and assaulting her. They had her wire up. She wore a recording device. We've all heard this recording.
Right.
And he admits it to her and he says, I'm used to that. So now you have this guy, you have a very credible witness in Ms. Gutierrez. You have a recording of him admitting that he molested her and that he's used to that. And Cy Vance, unknown to anybody at the time, goes, don't see it. And then later, when the media went crazy, he backtracked and he found a way to charge Harvey Weinstein, I guess better late than never, but he absolutely missed it the first time, as did the Cosby prosecutors, as did the Epstein prosecutors. And maybe someday we'll be saying, as did the Donald Trump prosecutors, we don't know.
You know, I think one of the most fascinating and dark figures in our political culture, who is in our celebrity culture, who is entwined with the political culture, the business culture, academia, is Jeffrey Epstein. And you cover Epstein in this book at a pretty fair clip. And tell us a little bit about why that particular prosecution took so long. And why? Yeah. I mean, there are still people weirdly out there, like Alan Dershowitz and others, who are still defending this guy to this day.
The Epstein saga, and I go through it in a bit in this book and I break it down, is really unbelievable. I mean that in the literal sense. Like, I can't believe this happened. So Epstein comes under suspicion of child molestation in Florida. Yep. And the case lands in front of Alexander Acosta, who was then the U.S. attorney, the top federal prosecutor in the Miami area, later to become Donald Trump's very briefly secretary of, I think it was, labor.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
Acosta. Now, Epstein goes out and hires himself this, forget about OJ's dream team. I mean, I'm not saying these lawyers are all great, by the way. I think some of them are actually quite poor at what they do, but they're all big names and they're all intimidating guys, right? Alan Dershowitz, Kenneth Starr passed away recently. The prior U.S. attorney from Miami, you know, five or six guys who would normally be like the headliner on a case, all on this case. And they all right. descend on Florida. And there's this unbelievable behind the scenes information on the pressure campaign they put on Acosta, the pressure campaign they put on his people. At some point, Acosta said, or other people say they're worried that they're going to be followed by Epstein's people and exposed personally mm-hmm. and all of this. The bottom line, and I lay out the whole saga in the book, the bottom line is Acosta agrees to let Epstein plead to a state level crime
right.
that calls for, I think it's 11 or 13 months in prison. And how does he end up serving that time?
It is mansion in Palm Beach.
almost close. He's released on daytimes and weekends to this place called Something Scientific, which is the same address as his attorney. So he's chilling in his attorney's office. Right. God knows what they had in there all day long. Now, this completely flies under the national radar. I had no idea this was happening in 2008, 2009, right? I don't know. I mean, 90% of the world. It was a deal in Florida, but it didn't really come out. When it blows up is when Alexander Acosta becomes Trump's cabinet member. And mm-hmm. then it gets into holy hell, what a wild injustice. And only then did my former office, the SDNY, we're 10 years later now, bring the heavy federal charges that he should have faced from the beginning. He goes into prison, he dies, we know the rest. But
right.
there's no way the SDNY brings that case without Acosta becoming a high profile figure and the media going, look at this. But the Jeffrey Epstein, it's hard for me to think of any example of anyone who got away with it more right. egregiously than him. Yeah.
Right. I think he really is sort of the alpha predator of these guys who,
yeah.
who, you know, and he ends up escaping it in death.
Yeah.
And even though he was in the MCC and he was, you know, on his way to trial, it still could have taken a lot of different twists and turns.
Absolutely.
And the fact yep. that the only person that's in jail about the whole thing is Ghislaine Maxwell, who is here right. where I am in Tallahassee, Florida,
is that right? Federal, is that where she was designated?
The Federal Women's Correctional Facility, teaching yoga and etiquette classes at here in Tallahassee in the prison.
Wow.
Yoga I did not and know etiquette. That.
God bless.
God bless. Let's hope she recovers.
Yeah.
Well, you know, one of the things that, you know, speaking of the high get away with it and the low get busted. The 1-6 folks. And I think, you know, we can talk about Jack Smith to whatever degree we talk about Jack yep. Smith as we go. But right now, the people that are getting prosecuted successfully and sent to jail or being fined are the lowest level minions and foot soldiers.
Yep.
They are the Yahoos who showed up because, you know, they got fired up, you know, listening to Steve Bannon's podcast and fired up listening to Trump say it'll be wild and fired up when Trump gave a speech. Why is it, and I get this question all the time, and I explain it as a non-lawyer all the time, you know, why is it none of the people that organized this, planned this, plotted this, encouraged this, schemed and conspired to put this thing together have faced any kind of justice? And what do you think the future looks like for the people who were in, say, the Willard War Room, at the right. level of like the Bannons and the Roger Stones and the Ali Alexanders and all the rest?
It's such an important question. It's one that I ask in the book. And in fact, I have the last chapter in the book is called Waiting for Garland. A little play on Waiting for Godot there.
Exactly.
Right? Look, as of this moment, and I say in the book, this could change. We legitimately don't know. We might see charges against Donald Trump, although I think it's becoming increasingly unlikely we see DOJ charge Donald Trump relating to January 6th. But as we sit here right now, you and me, Rick, we are 2+ years out from January 6th, 2021. Not a single person, forget about Donald Trump, not a single person with any smidge of political power or any proximity to political power has been charged with a damn thing. And I include members of Congress. I include John Eastman and Jeffrey Clark and Rudy and on down the line. And don't tell me, not you, but don't tell me the Oath Keepers. Yes, those are very important cases.
Sure.
They had to go after them. They did a good job. But those people are not politically powerful in the way we're talking about here.
Those are now, sergeants in this thing. They're not officers.
Right. They're dangerous and they're good cases. They had to be made, but that's not a substitute for going after the real power sources behind this.
Right.
And I'm critical of Merrick Garland in the following respects. One, he is just taking way too long. And people go, oh, these things take time. These things take time. I know. I was a prosecutor for 14 years. Not this much. You don't have to start with the guys in face paint and the horns and all that,
right,
you know,
right,
and work your way up. A, I argue in the book, We don't even know whether there is a direct connection between those folks. And you don't need it. He shouldn't need it. Because what Trump did and others did on their own is something that, that merits prosecution.
In the public eye, that's out there directly in public view.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to do like deep undercover investigation to know what they were saying, tweeting, doing.
Right.
But
and like, let me just say this one other thing.
Go, go.
The delay matters. It's not just a question of impatience. The longer you wait to charge this case, the harder it's going to be to convict for a couple reasons. One, the farther you get away from the event, the less immediate it seems to a jury, right? It's one thing to argue January 6th, you know, in late 2021. It's another thing. When is this case going to get, if let's assume Donald Trump gets indicted tomorrow by DOJ, when does this case get tried? You don't get to trial. We're into 2024. By this point, he's a candidate. He could be the nominee. I mean, good luck getting 12 people unanimously to convict on the eve of the 2024 election if he's the front runner.
And given the political culture he has built around himself, I have a slightly unpopular opinion. I think indictment actually helps him with his base.
That, I've heard that because it energizes.
I think they get pissed off and they go out and they say the deep state's trying to take out Donald. And I
But I agree. I mean, even less than that, look at Mar-a-Lago. The Mar-a-Lago search happened on August 8th. He had his biggest fundraising bump that he's had, you know, right then. I mean, and you know, there's been reporting, Olivia Nuzzi, I think a friend of yours, friend of mine, wrote a really interesting piece, as she always does, about how lackadaisical Trump's current 2024 campaign is. Well, nothing would energize it like an indictment. I don't think that's a reason not to indict. I think you got to do what you got to do, but you're right. That could be an impact. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that idea that there's almost a separate belief structure now among his supporters that, it may be the DOJ or the FBI, but those people aren't real. That's not the real, that's not the real justice we seek. As a listener to this podcast, you know democracy is in danger in America and beyond. This titanic challenge requires a powerful response, and that's why Resolute Square was founded. The Enemies List is part of the Resolute Square family. We're a pro-democracy network. The Enemies List is just one part of Resolute Square's pro-democracy content and coverage. Our members get particularly exciting benefits. Exclusive live roundtable discussions with me, Joe Trippi, Reed Galen, Stuart Stevens, and Tara Setmayer. In those discussions, you can ask us questions directly, as if you are in the room at a campaign strategy session. In these sessions, we'll give folks answers on how to fight back against the crazy, how to push back against the MAGA media, and how to communicate effectively in the battle for our democracy. We're building a new arsenal for democracy, and we could use your support. Head over to resolutesquare.com/enemies to let the world know where you stand. I guess, you know, one of the rules I was hearing about the book, it's like, I thought to myself, nobody with a driver on the 1-6 thing is going to get prosecuted or has been prosecuted. Nobody with a driver, nobody who uses a car service is in trouble.
We used to love to flip drivers in the mob. There's nobody. I flipped a driver named Howie Santos who one time. They're the best possible guys to flip. This guy wired up for us for months and months. He made the greatest recordings ever. So if you can flip a driver, then you're golden.
I love that. I love that. Yeah, that would seem like the, especially in this day and age where the mob boss is probably on a cell phone, you can bump up the recording and the phone records and everything
also,
else.
And, yes, and drivers are always pissed off because the boss goes, wait out here, and comes out 3.5 hours later. They're always disgruntled, so they're
right,
perfect.
Right. So that idea, though, that we're going to have, you know, the potential of a Trump trial being during the election, I just can't see how DOJ goes forward with it. I mean, they've been so cautious.
I should say,
they've been so, you know, so lax, not lackadaisical. I don't want to fully say that, but they have had a sort of they don't understand the cadence of American politics and media cycles. And in fact, but that's a lot of what your book's about, is these people exploit the cadence of attention in our society.
Exactly right. And also, look, just the pace is not acceptable for Merrick Garland. I mean, different prosecutors like different people run faster or slower. And what I say about Garland is he took a bureaucratic, myopic approach to this where he could have gone for the jugular, but instead he poked at every capillary. And as a result, here we are. Maybe he'll pull the trigger someday. Maybe he will. But I think it's there's a line that I quote in the book. There was a great underrated movie from the 90s called Searching for Bobby Fischer. You remember this? You ever see this?
Rick? I do.
The chess prodigy. And there's a great moment where the kid, who's, I don't know, 10 years old, offers two moves in. He offers a surrender to his opponent, who is the big bad guy.
Right.
And the opponent goes, "What the hell? What do you mean surrender? We just started." And the kid goes, "You've already lost. You just don't know it yet." Now, I don't know that that's necessarily the case, but I think, look, I know how long things take to investigate. I know that things are complicated. I cannot for the life of me understand why Merrick Garland, if he was focused and not myopic, couldn't have gotten this thing charged in late 2021, taken eight months, 9 months, right. 10 months. And we'd have done the trial by now. We'd be on trial right now. Instead, we're way, way, way far behind the eight ball. And we just had special counsel appointed, which is going to make this even more complicated.
So what do you think the role of the 1-6 committee played in the cadence of what Garland's doing and the pacing and the timing of what Garland has done or hasn't done? My theory of the case is that it hasn't had much effect at all.
Disagree, actually. But go ahead.
Really? Okay, tell me.
I have been critical of the 1-6 committee in some respects. I think they went light on their own colleagues, McCarthy and those guys, who blew off the subpoenas and nothing happened. But by and large, the committee, I think, did a remarkable job of fact-finding. And by the way, the committee has far less potent investigative and enforcement tools than DOJ does.
Oh, for sure.
I mean, I said in one of my articles, this is like a guy in a Tesla getting lapped by a kid on a big wheel. The fact that the committee was so far ahead of DOJ, right? And the committee gave us so much more information than DOJ had. Cassidy Hutchinson, to me, the most important witness we heard from.
Very DOJ important had witness.
Yes, the New York Times reported, and it's never been contravened, and it seems that when she was testifying, DOJ prosecutors were sitting on their couch like you and me, jaws agape, you know, astonished was the language that the New York Times used at what they were learning. They were behind the game on her, on Pat Cipollone. And I think by the January 6th committee, by making such a compelling presentation, I think they upped public pressure quite a bit to where DOJ had to get much more serious and step on the brake, step on the gas a little bit when it comes to Trump. Probably too late.
I take your point. My thought on it was, my sense at least was that they were over-focused on the small fish at DOJ.
For sure.
And didn't think, I think they might've considered it was never practical to get the big ones at DOJ. I feel like they'd almost written it off. At least that's my sense. And I don't have any like reasoning behind it other than I just know how Washington works. I had lived there way too long and felt like we can't really do that. So we might as well throw a lot of chaff in the air and arrest, you know, it's Stuart Rhodes and these other morons.
Right. If I had to guess, I mean, we don't have any proof of this. I don't think it was ever spoken that way. But if I had to guess and I could somehow access the deep inner sanctum of Merrick Garland's brain, I would guess that there was some like, this is too messy. We'll never get there. We don't want this. Let's try to appease them with some scraps and move on.
Right. So what's another story that people are going to find really amazing in Untouchable? Something that people haven't really focused on yet.
I report for the first time in this book on what happened with the Justice Department in my former office, the SDNY's hush money prosecution, which ended up being of only Michael Cohen, right? The payoff to Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal. Well, a lot of people wonder, as did I, how the hell could it be that for all the people who are involved in this, for all the people who benefited from this, the only person ever prosecuted was Michael Cohen, who went to prison for other crimes, but this too. And I have the behind the scenes story. In this book, I tell the story for the first time from all different perspectives of how on earth that came to be. And I don't want to give it all away, but I will tell you that the short version is the bosses at Main Justice, DOJ, stepped on certain aspects of what the SDNY wanted to do. And then ultimately the SDNY itself decided to back off. And you can sort of read why in the book, but I bring you back inside those halls of the SDNY.
Now I am excited. That's outstanding. Because I know Michael really well, and he is a passionate guy.
He's a friend of mine as well.
He's correctly passionate about trying to get to the bottom of this bullshit. Because, you know, even from a distance, the political level of let's excise Michael Cohen only and pretend he just did this on his own.
Yeah.
Astounding to me.
I mean, and you'll see how Alan Weisselberg and David Pecker and these other guys who are around this, how they all sort of managed to find their way between the cracks. And it's a remarkable story. It's actually, as I say in the book, look, I love the SDNY. I mean, I was raised there.
Sure,
it's
of
like
course.
A part of your, my family.
Yeah, it's home base.
But I think, you know, ultimately it's quite remarkable that the SDNY, the most powerful, feared, vaunted prosecutor's office in the country, could have taken a shot here. I'm not saying it was dead bang, and I have different views of the prosecutors in the book about how strong the case was, but they gave it a pass for reasons that I sort of lay out here, and I can leave it to people to decide whether those are legitimate or illegitimate. No, nothing, nothing nefarious, but just a question.
Sure,
of judgment.
Sure, but just not wanting to swing and miss, I'm sure is part of it.
Big part of it, yes.
Well, listen. So tell us a little more about when the book comes out and how we can reach you on social media.
The book comes out on January 31st. So one nice thing about having a weird name like Ellie Honig, unlike Rick Wilson, which there's probably 4,000 Rick Wilsons, is I'm the only one. There's not like Ellie Honig 08 or the real, you know, E-L-I-E-H-O-N-A-G. I'm on all the Twitter and all that stuff. I think people are really going to enjoy this book. And look, what I love about it is it's just a question that every single person has asked me in every single format. And what I try to do is give it a really modern, as you said, Rick, I don't view prosecutors in a vacuum. I know we prosecutors like to convey this notion that we are robots and we just kick ass, but we're humans and there are politics that come into play for better or for worse. So I hope that I can advance the answer to this question.
Well, Ellie, thank you so very much for coming on the podcast. Really a great conversation. Look forward to having you back on again. And I will I wish you all the best for a big splash with the book Untouchable: How Powerful People Get Away with It.
Thanks so much. Great talking to you.
Thanks.
Well, the enemies list this week, it's a broad entry. It's a broad entry because you've often observed, I'm sure, that the right-wing media complex moves in this unbelievable synchronicity, this insane degree of almost immediate adoption of the same message at the same intensity level that reinforces itself across different sectors of the right-wing media complex. And what we saw this week with the release of the police body cam footage from San Francisco during the attack on Paul Pelosi by a hammer-yielding assailant put the lie to something that the right-wing media complex was very, very, very invested in just a few weeks ago. Remember, when Pelosi was attacked in his home by a conspiracy-inflected, MAGA QAnon-inflected, or infected, if you will, by a guy named David DePape. Now, we're going to debate whether or not, at some point, DePape is mentally ill, or whether he's been activated and whatever conditions he had were enhanced and expanded by his exposure to the right-wing media ecosystem over the last few years, which he was apparently a frequent user. But the reason the folks today are on the enemies list is that for months, since October, when the attack occurred, there has been a favorite theory on the far right that this was some sort of gay tryst gone wrong, some sort of bondage game gone wrong. Well, what you saw in the police body cam video released this week was quite different. You saw an 82-year-old man scared out of his damn mind, holding onto the arm of a guy holding a hammer out of fear. He was holding the guy's, trying to hold the guy's arm so the guy wouldn't swing. And when the police knocked on the door of the Pelosi residence and it was opened by Paul Pelosi and the guy's lurking there in the background and they scream, "Drop the hammer," David DePape pulls the hammer back, all the way back, and winds up and smashes it into Paul Pelosi's head. It is unbelievably lucky that Paul Pelosi lived through this. But for months and months, the far right decided they were going to play games with this. They were going to, and then this is everybody from Seb Gorka to Don Jr. to Trump himself to Raheem Kassam, Glenn Beck, Roger Stone, all of them. Imagine the portfolio, the pantheon of the shitbird human beings that make up the kings and queens of the far right media, and they all took a bite of this, including Twitter Uber Lord Elon Musk, who tweeted immediately, "Oh, there's more to this story than meets the eye." Well, no, there wasn't. It was a violent assault by a guy who was activated by far-right propaganda. And the people who, after this new body cam video was released this week, if they had some vestigial sense of shame, they would have apologized, but they didn't. But there was another clip of video released at the same time that they have conveniently ignored, because their whole theory was, oh, Pelosi let him in the house. They knew each other. They were lovers, blah, blah, blah.
horseshit because the guy broke into the house and there's more video of him breaking into the house. So this is a really interesting example to me of why people should be on the enemies list, because they knew it was bullshit all along. They knew it was a lie from the very start. They knew it was complete dog shit from the second they started saying it and tweeting it. But why did they do it? Because they recognized the danger of acknowledging that the propaganda and the conspiracy theories and the insanity that they depend on, both for clicks and for engagement and for profit, activate people like David DePape into acts of violence. And he was activated into an act of direct political violence. And I find it remarkable, even now, even though I know better, even though I know these people like the worst 10 miles of bad road in South Georgia, even though I know who they are and what they are, even now, not one of them has come out to my knowledge after watching a piece of video of a madman swing a hammer at the head of an 82-year-old man with anything but more lies about it, with anything but more bullshit about it. You guys, and the list is long and indistinguished, but for all of you right-wing shitbirds who were pushing the lie that David DePape was Paul Pelosi's gay lover, get fucked. You're on the enemies list. I would tell you to get your shit together, but I know you never will. Thanks again for listening to the enemies list. If you have any comments, questions, or if there's someone you'd like to hear on the podcast, hit me up on Twitter at TheRickWilson. Thanks again for the wonderful support you've shown the pod. We're growing fast. It really helps if you will share this with your friends, your family, and anyone else who, like us, is trying to save democracy. While you're at it, if you could rate and review the podcast, I would be very much appreciative. I know this is the sort of thing you've heard a billion times. Please rate, review, like, blah, blah, blah. But you need to do it. It really does help us a lot. We are slaves to the algorithm, my friends. And if you do this, it will help get the pod out further. Anyway, thanks again for listening. I'll see you next time. And remember, whatever you do, stay off the list.
Did you know that most vitamin D3 supplements come from sheep's wool? I'm Kat, founder of Ritual. We're making traceability the new standard for the supplement industry. When I was pregnant, I couldn't find a multivitamin I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested, and clean label project certified. Oh, and our vitamin D3? It comes from sustainably harvested lichen from England, not sheep. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.